For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. I'm your host Red Sail, and coming up in this week's show, as the judges ponder the novels on this year's Philip Carnegie shortlist, we'll be talking to some of the authors. Lauren Woke discusses the inspiration behind Beyond the Bright Sea.
And then the next thing I knew, there was this little baby emerging in my imagination, strapped into a leaky boat and washing up on a shore.
Marcus Sedgwick takes us on the run in Mexico with Saint Death.
She looks like our Grim Reaper with the scythe in one hand and maybe the world in the other, depicting, you know, fate and justice and so forth.
And Anthony McGowan reveals his commitment to making books accessible for all.
Probably now my main way of consuming books, because I'm a cyclist, so I always have an audiobook going on in my head while I'm cycling around, which is probably not entirely safe, but
that's all coming up in today's Read On. Lauren Woke is an American author of pre-teen fiction. But like all the best children's literature, her books are also loved by adults. Her debut novel, Wolf Hollow, attracted widespread acclaim, and its follow-up, Beyond the Bright Sea, has been shortlisted for this year's Philip Carnegie Medal. She joined me down the line from her home in Cape Cod. Lauren Woke, welcome to Read On.
Thank you so much for having me.
Beyond the Bright Sea is a story about a foundling, a child of the sea. For those of the listeners who haven't read it yet, could you just tell us a little bit more?
Sure. And I love the way you put that, that she's a foundling and a child of the sea. I consider myself a child of the sea as well. In fact, the Atlantic Ocean inspired this book. I always start with setting, so I chose the time to be the 1920s and the place to be the Elizabeth Islands, which are a string of islands off of the coast of Cape Cod, where I live. So if any of your listeners have been to Martha's Vineyard, they've been very close, or Cape Cod, they've been very close to the Elizabeths. Beautiful little stretch of islands. And I imagined what those islands might have been like in the 1920s for anyone living there. And then the next thing I knew, there was this little baby emerging in my imagination, strapped into a leaky boat and washing up on a shore, which of course then meant I had to imagine who might find her. And out of the blue comes this man named Osh, who collects her up and raises her as his own. And there are many complications, of course, not just in living in a wild place surrounded by a wild sea, but also in the mystery of where this baby has come from. So I just followed them through their lives, through the adventure of their lives, and wrote down what I saw and heard and what they told me. So it was a really wonderful experience.
You clearly did a lot of research. There's some beautiful pieces of history that come through Guttyhunk, the island in the Elizabeths, where the most of the action is set, is where Captain Kidd might have buried some of his treasure, and also that it's believed by some to be the island that Shakespeare based the island in The Tempest on.
Yes, I was fascinated to learn that. I tend to do research after I've begun to write in order to answer my own questions, because I always want to direct the research and not the other way around. I want to include only what my characters really need to know, what I need to know, what the readers need to know in order to be immersed in this world. So I relied on what I already knew about the sea, because it hasn't really changed that much in the last century, and what I know about living on an island. And then from there, I investigated what life would have been like in the 20s on Guttyhunk and the other Elizabeths. And I found information like Captain Kidd's story, which I really hadn't known before. And it was way too enticing to leave out. So I worked some threads of that fact into my fiction and other things I discovered as well. But I tried very hard to let my characters decide where the story would go, and not let the research guide them too much. It's always a delicate balance.
Crow, your heroine, is a child who is excluded by association with disease, without giving too much away, which is something that I think many of our blind listeners would actually feel rather a kinship with. Where did the inspiration for the character of Crow and her situation come from?
That's a very good question. As just a kernel of an idea, she appeared, you know, in this boat without any history. And I really didn't know, because I never know when I write a book what's going to happen. I don't want to know. I don't plan it out. I just really follow my instincts and my characters. And so I knew she would lead me somewhere interesting. And of course, because I'm from Cape Cod and I know the Elizabeths, I knew that there was this sort of this island off the edge of this string called Penikees, which is different from the others, not only in the fact that it's a little separated from them, but also in its history. It was the site of some very unusual things, and I too do not want to give too much away, but some very frightening things. And so there was, in my imagination and in the minds of the other characters in the book, the possibility that Crow had come from this other island, Penikees, and brought with her some threat to others. And so I wondered what would happen, whether it would turn out that she was indeed from Penikees or somewhere else on the mainland, and what her backstory was. But yeah, the possibilities were endless. And that, in fact, is how she feels as well. And that's what sends her on a quest to find out her roots and other aspects of her identity, although she also knows that where she is very important, not just where she used to be.
I thought that was one of the most lovely aspects of the book, that a story set 100 years ago is a warning to children and young adults that sometimes discovering too much about the world and the history around you can be damaging, and that perhaps one should be happy with what one knows.
Well, I agree with you. I think it's always good to be curious. It's always good to seek answers to your questions. But we always have to remember how blessed we are with what we have in our hands right now. And Crow also, leading back to your former question, although she is perceived as a threat, she knows in her heart, as do the people who love her, and eventually even the people who are sort of afraid of her, she knows that she is a good person, a person worth knowing, a person who really should not be an object of fear or loathing, that just because she's potentially different, and because she is different, as we are all different, just because she's unique does not mean that she should be perceived in some way as a threat or an anomaly, unless it's in a good way. You know, I'm talking a little in circles here, and it's because it's a complicated thing. We are all unique. We are all different. But that is a good thing. That is something that we should embrace and celebrate. It should not separate us, the fact that we are different. It should bring us together. So Crow, I hope, if she's an example for readers in this day and age, I hope it is because she reminds us that we should value who we are and what we have in the here and now, and not always be trying to change one another or the lives we have.
And there's a wonderful line that really resonated with me, that we are what we do, which is both a caution and an encouragement.
Yes, I have what many people call unwanted thoughts. If you have an imagination, your mind takes you places you don't necessarily want to go. It's what we do that I think is most important, and how we treat one another. So although I occasionally feel guilty for where my imagination takes me, I also recognize that that's the product of an active brain, and it's what I do with other people in my life that really matters the most. And sometimes, in fact, what I do is directed by the idea that I want to be stronger than anything I might imagine. I want to be deliberate. I want to be in charge of who I am and how I act in this world. And for me, the goal is to do no harm, to be kind, to be courageous, to be thoughtful.
At the end of the book, you give some author's notes, which give a great insight into how you write. And I love the fact that you say that Crow appeared to you as a guide and led you through the story. Does that mean that perhaps you didn't know how it would end up when you started?
I had no idea. I had no idea what would happen at all, except there would be this place and there would be this child and she would have a life. That's it. It's truly an adventure when you write that way. I tried once plotting out a book so that I knew how it would end, and it felt like work the whole way through, and it read like work. Tedious, boring, linear, and I never tried it again. So this book, like Wolf Hollow and other things I've written, is really an adventure, and Crow was just the most fantastic guide. She said, did, thought things I did not anticipate. It's like having a child. You know, you watch them, you see them develop, you learn them as they grow. She was the same way. And so it was a joy and very exciting because it was a mystery. No, I did not know how it would end. When I came to the end, I had a couple of choices, and I really let her decide how things should go.
Like all the best books, it can be read by people of all ages. Although I know that when you have been interviewed in the past about Wolf Hollow, your previous book, you say it started as an adult's book and then became a book for children and young adults. Do you recognise any distinct traits that separates adult fiction from young adult fiction, or do you just write for the broadest audience and then see what the publisher says?
Well, that's an interesting question. So yes, I did write Wolf Hollow thinking it would be for an adult audience because that's the audience I had always written for. And I was surprised when my agent and then subsequently editor said, no, this is a very good book for a young audience, but we also think it will resonate with adults. And I was thrilled about that. I wrote Beyond the Bright Sea before Wolf Hollow was even published because I did not want to be swayed by the reaction to Wolf Hollow. I did not want to be pigeonholed. I did not want to be distracted by things like that. I really just wanted to write a good story. I knew that my publisher would publish Beyond the Bright Sea for a middle grade audience, for young adult audience primarily, but their designation was ages 10 and up, which I loved because it's really such a broad audience. And I was very careful, even though I knew what was expected of me, to really put my characters first and let them be in charge. So I would say that I do not, and I've written a book subsequently too, which follows the same philosophy, that a good story well told is the goal. And that, as you say, and thank you, I love that, that the best books are for all readers. I love reading books for all ages, if they're good books. So that, as a writer, is my goal, and I hope to achieve that.
You also must be thrilled that you've been shortlisted for the Philip Carnegie Medal.
I couldn't be more honored, truly. I am very thrilled. I am sincerely honored. It doesn't matter if I win that award. The fact that I am in the company of other fine writers and that I'm receiving recognition from such a venerable organization, and most importantly, that my work is being read by people across the UK. It's beyond belief, and it really is truly an honour.
We're very lucky at the RNIB because of an arrangement between the Royal National Institute for Blind People and the organisers of the Philip Carnegie Medal. All the books are made accessible in Braille, giant print, and as audiobooks. And something you might not know is that the winner of the medal is presented with a Braille copy of of their book. It's obviously important for you that your books reach a broader audience. Is there an audiobook version in the States coming over to the UK?
Yes, absolutely, there is. And first of all, I love, love, love the idea that you present a Braille version to the winner. I think that is spectacular. And the fact that it's available in Braille, that these books are available in Braille and in giant print and in audio is fantastic. Yes, there is an audio version of Beyond the Bright Sea. I will be packing one in my bag to bring over there for you. But yes, and I'm very, very happy with how they've treated it. The reading is marvelous.
Lauren Wolk, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you very, very much.
Thanks to a long-standing agreement between RNIB and the organisers of the Silip Carnegie Medal, all the books on the shortlist are available in a full range of accessible formats to members of the RNIB library. So, Beyond the Bright Sea is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB405777. Thanks again to Lauren Wolk, who'll be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio, exploring the world through books and reading. Coming up later on today's show, Anthony McGowan explores first love, bullying and the West Riding of Yorkshire in his new novel, Rook. But first, Marcus Sedgwick is a writer and illustrator and is no stranger to the Silip Carnegie judges. Over the years, no fewer than 7 of his novels for children and young adults have been shortlisted for the award. Most recently, Saint Death. Set on the wrong side of the Mexican border, it starts with the epigraph. This book is about the stories that occur over there, across the river. The comfortable way to deal with these stories is to say they are about them. The way to understand these stories is to say they are about us. He joined me down the line to tell me more. Saint Death is quite an angry book. In the nicest possible way, I read it and I felt that I should be rather outraged by what's going on in Mexico.
Yeah, that's. I think you've hit the nail right on the head right from the start, and it's something that I think I was aware of when I was writing it, because very often when you're writing a book, you're trying to gauge how much emotion to put on the page, and even if you're writing something that's very emotional, the danger of overwriting if you let yourself go is always there, and I've always tried to sort of maintain that balance. And then, having spent a couple of years doing the research for this book and reading about all sorts of appalling things, I did feel very angry. And I finally thought, what the heck? I'm going to see what happens if you just let go and put all that anger into a book. And as you say, if you felt that way reading it, then that's the desired effect, because that's very much how I felt writing it.
It's given extra poignancy by just how close salvation, hope, is the other side of the fence to the border with Juarez.
That's right. And borders in the broadest sense of the word, metaphorically, allegorically, are always interesting to writers, because often stories are about change, they're about people changing, there are moments of conflict or crisis in people's lives. So you'll often find that writers have a lot of fun with borders. And then in this case, because it's a very literal, physical, proximal thing as well, I felt that even more powerfully. And when I went out to Mexico, to Juarez, and was standing on Mexican soil, 10 feet from the fence, and there's American sand, I should say, 10 feet the other side, It was a very strange feeling. It's very hard to, it sounds simplistic to say, but it was quite hard to get my head around why it was that I would be able to leave the following day or whenever with my passport and fly back wherever I wanted to fly to, but someone else standing there wouldn't have that option. Because it is, so, and particularly the exact spot that I was writing about was carefully chosen, because there is a fence there, which is a fence that's been there for 20 years, mid-90s, some of the fences, existing fences, go back to. And it's one of the points where the fence stops. So you're looking at this 20-foot-high iron fence, and then it stops, and there's a bare patch of desert around which you could easily walk. Although, of course, there are other things that would prevent you from doing that, even if you wanted to. But yeah, as I say, it sounds a bit obvious, but I really did find it hard to comprehend.
And the book is full of, tantalising language, tomorrow and hope, and almost is a word that keeps resonating through the book. Both your main characters, Arturo and Faustino are almost within reach of the life that they want to lead, that they, well, the life that we expect our children to lead, and that is almost beyond hope for them.
That's right. And again, I mean, this goes it goes back to the idea of thresholds yet again, because they're almost men as well. And I'm very careful not to specify their exact age, because I don't think that's the most important thing. It's about people, young people, who are on the threshold of trying to become something else. And one of the things they're trying to become is simply to survive and become adults, and, you know, to reach that state. So I was playing with those ideas quite a lot in the book too. There's a lot of things to do with bridges. There's quite a lot of symbolism of the number five, which I chose because Carl Jung had a theory. Carl Jung being into all sorts of strange things, being into numerology and the symbolism of numbers. And for him, the number five being halfway along the line from one to nine represented the state of the bridge. And of course, the bridge is there again in very literal terms. There are four bridges in Juarez that link Mexico to America. El Paso, Texas, and Juarez, Mexico, are kind of, I think I described them as conjoined twins in the book. Once upon a time, it was just one big city, and now it has a river that runs through it. And the northern half is El Paso, which is, I think I'm right in saying, one of the top three safest towns for its size in the whole of America. And on the other side of that, just literally 20 yards away, you have Juarez, which, as of the time of writing, it's a little bit safer now, was the most murderous city on the planet. And it's that kind of environment that you're describing that Arturo and Faustino are trying to negotiate and survive and escape from.
In the epigraph that you put at the beginning of the book, it is very much a case of, well, there but for the grace of God walk we. This might be happening in Mexico, but it could just as easily happen somewhere else.
Well, I mean, I again, it sounds a bit simplistic, but that really is what I feel. And I think it really, I guess, it divides two ways of thinking about the world into two very broad camps of people, of whether you see the world as them and us, and I'm fine over here, so thank God for that, or whether you think, as you say, there but for the grace of God. And as I said, as I felt standing there, knowing that I had my passport in my pocket and I'd be leaving whenever I wanted to leave, it was very different from a situation from lots of the other people that I was encountering in Juarez and Anapra. And that epigraph is by this fantastic journalist I came across, who sadly died about 4 years ago, I think, whose name was Charles Bowden, but he was a veteran observer of life along the Mexican-American border. He'd lived in both sides of the border for many years. And I kind of became a bit obsessed with his work and his writing, because he was a journalist and he was writing nonfiction, but I felt that his prose was so electric. And I think that's where some of the anger came from, actually, that I put into the book, because reading a lot of his writing was literally like being slapped around the face. He'd say very provocative things, and then you question him and you think, why am I thinking this? And you could see just how much anger he had, although I would say perhaps slightly ameliorated by the length of time and the wisdom that comes with age, of having witnessed these things for so long. And the epigraph is a quote from one of his books that basically says, you know, you can look at these stories in two ways, but the way to understand it is to imagine that these stories are about us.
For those who haven't yet read the book, it begins with an almost Faustian pact. In fact, one of your characters is called Faustino. Faustino comes to visit his friend Arturo, basically demanding help.
You're right, it is a very Faustian pact, and hence the name. And I was determined that, given that I'm working with quite complicated material in terms of, you know, the politics, the economics of what's going on, it'd be very easy to end up getting bogged down in that and have a heavy, dry book to read. And I wanted this to be a book that worked through a form of a thriller by making you really want to read the story. And so I like it when you can find an idea that's really simple. Like an idea like revenge is a really simple idea to underpin a book. And in this case, it is this, can we get out of this Faustian deal within 36 hours or not? And if unless Arturo wins and wins big at this card game that Faustino has dispatched him to, then both of them, not just Faustino, are going to end up in big trouble. And that I think is, I was just trying to have a mechanism that made it kind of drive along really fast so that then the other stuff I wanted to say would slip in more easily on the side.
And the third character who looms above all the action is Santa Muerta, who is, a gritty street saint who also represents death.
Absolutely fascinating. And it was really the starting point for the book was that by chance I met a young Mexican writer and academic, Gabby Silvera, and she told me over dinner one night about this figure who's Mexico's a Catholic country, so therefore most people are Catholics and worshipping the traditional Catholic saints, and the most famous one being the Virgin of Guadalupe, who's an official authentic saint of the Catholic Church. But then there's this growing number of people who have kind of bolted on, if you like, the worship of Santa Muerta, who is, as you say, her name translates literally as Holy Death or Saint Death. She's a figure, she's a skeleton in a dress. She has various depictions, but she looks like our Grim Reaper with the scythe in one hand and maybe the world in the other, depicting fate and justice and so forth. But she's very definitely a female figure, and she's interesting. No one knows where she came from, even whether she originated in Mexico or further south in South America, or whether she came in via Cuba. No one really knows, and no one really knows when she started either. But and no one knows how many people are worshipping her, because it's a kind of very much an underground thing. But all sorts of people, from lords of the drug gangs, the big narco lords, to their victims, to poor people, to prostitutes, to prisoners, to prison officers, police officers, all sorts of different people worship her, particularly in places, some of the slum areas in Mexico City. There are some quite interesting shrines to her. And then from time to time, the Mexican government has been trying to shut these down and bulldoze them and kind of erase them from view. But of course, people always have that habit of believing what they want to believe and worshipping who they want to worship. Very interesting. What I like about it is it's a very kind of, as you say, down to earth, kind of gritty street kind of thing. It's not like a remote saint, like a divine figure that you go into an ornate church to worship. She is someone you can have a shrine at home, and you give her something in the form of an offering of some kind, and that could be something as simple as a can of Coke or a couple of cigarettes or a little bit of money, and you hope that in giving her something she will give you something that you desperately require.
And very emblematic of the people she serves, as comes out in the book. Young women are unfortunately quite likely to be murdered in Juarez, and actually perhaps the release and the eternity of the afterlife that Santa Muerta offers is the peace and the freedom that actually that population will never get on Earth.
That's right, and very sadly, to focus on women briefly, there was a very bad spate for a number of years called the femicide, in which the young women were going missing, basically being chewed up as products of the drug trade in its broadest sense, abductions and rapes and murders. And this is another one of those things where it's hard not to get angry, because quite a number of these women, young women, work in these large internationally owned factories. They're not Mexican owned factories. They're on Mexican soil, but they're owned by global corporations, and they're paid very, very low wages, practically slave labor. Someone described to me, a local described it to me. And they have very, very harsh employment rules. I mean, there are no unions to speak of, and no legislation to protect you at work. So all sorts of stories of young women turning up for work, and maybe their bus breaks down that's getting them to work, so they're 5 minutes late for work and they get the sack. If they get pregnant, they get the sack. All sorts of different things like this. And of course, the factories are able to do this because there's a large population. They're desperate for work, so they can just chew through people. And quite a few stories of people who were turned away from factory gates for being late or whatever, then having to walk the long distance home and then being abducted. And this is when you start to feel angry, especially when you factor in that there's no particular help coming from the official law enforcement. There's a kind of such a high rate of corruption within the police forces within Juarez. There's apparently about a 1 in 3 chance that any police officer you turn to is going to be actually in the pay of a gang. And that obviously is going to prevent you from even reporting a crime, never mind having any hope of finding a loved one who's gone missing. And so, of course, it's no wonder that people turn to something else, and that's something else that lots of people are turning to at the moment, is Santa Muerte.
Has the book been well received in the United States and Mexico?
Mexico, I don't know. It hasn't had a foreign edition, a co-edition, as far as I'm aware. There, it was published in America about 6 months after, so that had been April of last year, I think it was published. And I did a book tour at the time, and it went over very well. And in some cases, I was down in Texas and relatively close to the border. And at least the people I spoke to, I was mostly speaking to librarians, who were very pleased to have it, actually, because a lot of them, particularly from schools who worked in schools close to the border, were saying, we don't have enough books on these kind of subjects. And they had a lot of Mexican immigrant population in their schools, and they want books that are going to help not just for those people, but also for other children to understand what the situation is. So as far as I know, yeah, it's been well received.
And of course, it's been very well received over here, and the librarians who choose the shortlist for the Philip Carnegie Medal have put it on there. This is, of course, your seventh time of being shortlisted?
It is, yeah. Yeah, it is.
Are you hopeful this year for eventual victory?
I don't know. I've stopped worrying about it too much. It used to really... Gnaw at me, but I these days I think being on the shortlist is such a great thing anyway. I really mean this. It's such an honor to be chosen by people who really know what they're doing in the work of literature for young people, but B, the effect it has on the profile of the book, and it gets loads of kids reading in schools through the shadowing scheme, which is, you know, last time I heard a number, I mean, it's tens and tens of thousands of children who get involved in the shadowing scheme. Also, as the years gone by, I've kind of realised that prizes are, you know, and I've been involved in judging a couple of prizes over the years, and you realise that it is very much down to the right constellation of stars falling in place on any particular day. So if it happens, I'd be delighted. If it doesn't, it's fine too.
Well, as you know, one of the byproducts of the Carnegie Medal is that accessible versions of all the shortlisted books are supplied to the RNIB library, so there are Braille, giant print, and a talking book version.
It's another reason that actually it's very personally important to me that the books appear in Braille editions and in the RNIB library, because this is something I came across a few years ago. I wrote a book called She Is Not Invisible, which had a blind protagonist in it, and when I set out to do that, I thought, I can't do this without the help of experts. And I spent a long time in a school in Worcester called New College Worcester, which is kind of a unique place. I think it's the only school of its exact type for visually impaired and blind children in the country. And I made a lot of friends there and spent a lot of time with Kathy in the library there. And I could see how important it was that they had Braille editions and audio editions, equally important, to read, and as many as possible. And the number of books that end up in Braille and sadly also an audio is still such a small percentage of all available books. So it means a lot to me to know that there'll be a Braille edition of this book as well.
And actually, if you win, the Chief Librarian at the RNIB Library will present you with a Braille copy of your own book.
That's fantastic. And they're amazing things to see. I mean, I'm sure your listeners are familiar with this, but I'd never seen one before. I went to New College Worcester for the first time, and to see, you know, your slim little book appears in 6 or 8 or 10 or 12 enormous white volumes on the shelf is fantastic.
Marcus Sedgwick, thank you so much for appearing as a guest on Read On.
That's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to Marcus Sedgwick. St. Death is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB405782. A wide selection of his other books is also available from the RNIB Library in a range of accessible formats. For more details, visit the website rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and select option 5.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
Anthony McGowan's skills as an author span all age ranges and many genres. By turns deadly serious and side-splittingly funny, his books never shy away from life's harsh realities. This is particularly true of his young adult fiction, in which he's addressed such issues as brain tumours and knife crime. Rook, his latest novel, is no exception, and it's shortlisted for this year's Philip Carnegie Medal, which recognises the best in children's and young adult fiction. He came into the studios to tell me more. Anthony McGowan, welcome to Read On.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. So far.
I'll try and keep it that way. Many congratulations on being shortlisted for the Philip Carnegie Medal this year. Rook is a fantastically compact book. I know it's aimed at children and young adults who find reading difficult, either because of dyslexia or whatever. Could you tell us a little bit more about the story?
Yeah, well, I suppose it's a third, not quite in a trilogy, but the third in a series of linked books about two main characters, who are Nicky and Kenny. Now, Nicky's the younger brother, but his older brother has learning difficulties, so Nicky's been kind of his carer over the course of the three books. And in the very first one, their family's in a very, very bad place. Their mother's abandoned them when they were quite little. Their father's basically fallen apart. So Nicky really has this huge responsibility to look after the family and keep it together. By the time that Rook's come along, the family's a little bit more together. Things are going slightly better, but still life is full of problems for young people.
As anybody who's familiar with your work will recognise, it blends humour with the harsh realities of life without actually detracting from the impact of either.
Yeah, well, the other two books are rather more sombre. Brock, the first one, Pike is the second one. Their life is so difficult. Basically, it's all about getting through. By the stage of Rook, things are a little bit easier, as I said. So there's more of a space for humour. So there's a bit of what I would term body comedy in it before things again turn a little bit darker. But I've throughout my career, I've tried to do those two things of mixing comedy with more serious themes.
Certainly the themes are very serious in Rook. Bullying, there's fractured families, and yet throughout it all there's a compassion which actually comes very much from caring for the injured Rook that the two boys find.
Yeah, I suppose it is like a symbol of the of the healing power of love. But in the two earlier books, sorry, I keep hopping back to them. Nicky has been, I suppose, genuinely heroic, that he's had this huge burden and he's coped amazingly well. I think in Rook, I wanted to show him almost breaking under the pressure. it's all been in a way too much for him because he's got, as well as the problems of bullying, he's also in love for the first time, which, for a teenager, could be quite a traumatic experience based on my experiences. For the first time in this, he does kind of slightly go off the rails, Nicky. But then I wanted to show him then having a kind of healing process. Also, in the previous books, although he's been Kenny's carer in a sense, he's become, I suppose, dependent on Kenny as well. So it's a completely mutual relationship. And in Rook, Kenny's becoming a bit more independent. And so there's a slight gap there in Nicky's life as well. So he almost needs Kenny as much as Kenny needs him.
And I think certainly in the character of Kenny, you deal with the frustration of disability very sensitively and in a way that I think any of us who have a disability will recognise, the frustration that of Kenny's very slow reading, which you express as like driving in a traffic jam.
Yeah, well, I suppose that what I wanted to avoid was having too obviously my adult perspective on disability. So I wanted to see Kenny's problems through the eyes of Nicky. So in one of the earlier books, he describes Nicky as Kenny as being simple, which is obviously a term that many adults would find in some way offensive. But for Nicky, it sums up his brother, who sees things in a simple, straightforward way. So the whole time I was trying to get into Nicky's head rather than my adult Guardian reading kind of perspective. So often, yeah, Nicky does find Kenny frustrating and annoying, and apart from anything else, they are siblings, and siblings don't always get on that well. But there is that undercurrent of love which helps to heal those fractures.
You also write in the book that life is all about stories, and it's very much, we all want to tell our own stories. Other people might not necessarily enjoy them, but they are our stories.
Absolutely, yes. It's been a theme throughout all the books that often, you know, Nicky literally tells Kenny stories a lot of the time. Often that's a theme that goes through the books. So again, it's stories of how we understand our lives, how we understand ourselves.
This set of books that Brooke is the third in the series of is published by Barrington Stoke, who specialise in publishing books for those who find reading difficult.
Yeah.
And they make some adaptations to the print copies, don't they?
Yes, so the physical object they produce, as well, apart from anything else, is really beautiful. They make a very, very lovely book. But so the paper's very thick and creamy, and it's lovely to sign, I've got to say. But yes, so there are issues with dyslexia around just the difficulty in physically seeing the text on the page. So the font is very carefully chosen, the colour of the paper is very carefully chosen to make it easy for people with dyslexia to read. So that's a physical aspect of it, but also in terms of the style. I mean, before I started writing for Barrington Stoke, my style was quite ornate. You know, I was very much a look how clever I am kind of writer. And I was forced to pare down that style for Barrington Stoke. And I'm sure it made me actually a better writer. You know, I really did focus on what a story is really about, and those characters and the plot and getting that story told, rather than saying, look what a dab hand at metaphor I am. So I think those two things together make them more accessible. But it's not just for dyslexics. It's also just the teenagers who haven't read very much. And so the fact they're quite short means it's certain quite short chapters. It means you have that satisfaction of finishing each chapter and then finishing the book, which is quite important. But also I hope that they would appeal to the general teenage reader.
And I think actually to adult readers as well. I mean, certainly it's not very often that I will listen to a synthetic voice book and be absolutely gripped from beginning to end. It's a very impactful story and very concisely told. It has the impact of a fable in some ways. And I think part of that is actually because it has that timeless storytelling which involves animals and humans on the same page.
Mm. That was always part of my idea right from the very beginning. All three books involve Nicky and Kenny, that the lives are entwined with nature. In the first book, they find a badger that's been seriously hurt by badger baiters. In the second book, there's a kind of fish element. In the third book, it's a rook. Actually, a librarian pointed out a while ago that it almost seems like in three books, the first one is an earth book, the second one is a water book, and this one is an air book, which I hadn't kind of thought about it. I think it's a really kind of brilliant insight into them. And yeah, I see what you mean about the kind of fable aspect too. But that's also partly just to do with the geography of the books, which is the geography of the small town in Yorkshire where I was brought up. It's a place called Sherburn in Elmet. Anyone who's been there, lived there, would recognise it instantly from the books. But that it's a former kind of, it was a mine, it's in the middle of the Selby coalfield, so it had a mining aspect to it, like a slightly, almost an industrial element. There were kind of, there's a big bacon processing factory there, but it's also very close to the fields and the woods of the West Riding of Yorkshire. So my life growing up was this kind of weird liminal space, but you know, half urban, half rural. And I wanted to kind of capture that again in the books, how they're that you know, that it's not as if they don't live in the countryside, but almost because of that, the countryside is more important. It's just it's a short walk away into that sort of different world.
Are you planning another book in the series? Is Kenny? Are we going to find out whether whether Kenny gets the girl?
Well, you know, I didn't. I always thought something about a trilogy, about three that seems complete. But I've started writing a fourth because I thought I should bring their mother back from Canada. She's that they kind of rediscover her, that she's been living in Canada. So I wanted a slight reunion there, but right at the end of it. But I'm writing one called Lark at the moment, which involves them getting lost on the North Yorkshire moors and nearly dying. But I had no plans to. It came somehow, just spontaneously. That happens sometimes when you're a writer. Things don't always happen quite as you plan them.
You're no stranger to being shortlisted for and winning literary prizes. Are you excited about the Carnegie Medal?
Oh, hugely excited. The Carnegie is, it's a very special award, partly because it's made of solid gold. Did you know that? No, well, that's always not the most important thing. But it's always had a massively high reputation among writers. It's decided by incredible librarians who really know their stuff. So among writers, it's the one that we all really crave. And even being shortlisted is a genuine, massive, massive honour. So, no, I was colossally excited about it.
And if you were to win, you will, of course, receive a Braille copy of your own book.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. That would be a beautiful thing to have.
Clearly, you feel very strongly about making books accessible to readers. Mm. Are you an audiobook fan yourself?
Oh, I am. It's probably now my main way of consuming books because I'm a cyclist, so I always have an audiobook going on in my head while I'm cycling around, which is probably not entirely safe. But so, yep, I never don't have an audiobook on the go. And I think it's an incredible way to absorb a text. As you know better than I do, the reader is so important. And when you find a good audiobook reader, it's one of the most intimate relationships you could possibly have, I think, in the world of arts, that reader right in your head there.
And you're going to do a reading for us yourself, aren't you, today?
Happy to.
Fantastic. Well, this is Anthony McGowan reading Rook, the book that has been shortlisted for the 2018 Philip Carnegie Medal.
Basically, Nicky, who has been fairly heroic throughout the series, he's cracking up a bit under the strain of love and bullying, I suppose, and he's gone storming off to his bedroom, having a big row with his father and his brother. I share my room with Kenny, so I knew he'd show up in the end. Dad says you're a silly bugger, but not to mind, as you've had a bad day, he said, as he put his Spider-Man pyjamas on. He'd had them forever, and they only came up halfway up his legs, but every time Dad tried to chuck them out, Kenny got them back from the bin. I don't think he even liked Spider-Man, it was just the pyjamas. I didn't say anything, so Kenny carried on. Rookie ate more worms, and he got better for a while, and he moved about in his box. Then he got poorly again. A dad said he might have got germs in him, and that he should have some medicine to kill the germs. A dad said if we waited, you'd come down to get some dinner and play with Rookie, but you didn't. Shut up, Kenny, I said. I'm trying to sleep. I'd forgotten that I was hungry, but it's too late now. Okay, Kenny said. Tell me a story. I used to read to Kenny a lot when we were little. Books from the library because we didn't have any books in the house, except one about fishing, which my mum had given my dad for Christmas before she went away. Kenny loved it when I read to him, but he liked it even more when I made stuff up. He called that a story by mouth. I think what he liked about the story by mouth was that it could go on forever, unlike a book which comes to an end. He was always afraid that the book would be finished before he was ready. No, I said, just go to sleep. I can't unless you tell me a story. Well, I'm not in the mood. If you don't tell me a story, I'm going to do humming. Kenny sometimes did a sort of tuneless humming, which he said was to help him sleep, but I think he knew it was so irritating I'd give in and tell him a story. He was right, usually. But tonight I was too annoyed and upset. If I told him a good story, he'd want me to go on for hours. So I thought my only chance of getting this crappy day over and done with was to tell him a really rubbish one. All right then, I said, be quiet and I'll get started. Sometimes you can hear someone smile, a sound like someone carefully taking the wrapping off a present. Then there was a scratching at the door. Kenny got out of bed and let Tina in. She always slept on his bed, even though it meant he had a dog's bum in his face all night. What's it called? Kenny asked when he was back in bed with Tina settled next to him. It's called Rook. Is it about Rookie? Yeah, sure, maybe, whatever. Right, so was this Rook, and he was a young'un, not long out of the nest, so he knew sod all about staying alive. Then one day it got killed by a sparrowhawk, because that's what sometimes happens in nature. The strong ones kill the weak ones, and then they eat them. That's not right, Kenny said. Shut up. But it didn't eat him. Your story's wrong. Rookie's alive. Fine, then. This Rook didn't get eaten straight away, because two stupid lads thought they could save it. So it lived for a couple of days in pain. Then it died, and it went in the bin. And that proves you shouldn't mess with the law of nature, because you can't change it. And it would have been better for the Rook if it just died and been eaten by the sparrowhawk. The end. I looked over at Kenny. His face was all screwed up, and he had his fingers in his ears. I felt rotten. I'd never done this before. Hurting Kenny, I mean. Hurting him on purpose. I hated myself. Maybe that's why I did it, to give myself a good reason to hate myself. I'd found a black cave of hate and crawled into it, like a ghoul from the churchyard crawling into an old grave. I lay awake until I heard Kenny's breathing become slow and regular. Then I heard my dad's heavy, weary tread on the stairs. And then I waited a while longer. I don't know how long, because time is weird when you're lying awake. And then I crept down to the kitchen and peered into Rookie's box. Kenny had put twigs and leaves and dried grass in there for him. I think he tried to make it look like a nest. "Hey there, Rookie," I said. The rook looked up at me, and I looked down at him. He was a mess, feathers missing from his back and breast. I stroked him, and this time he didn't fight it. I scooped him up and sat on the kitchen floor with him on my lap. He stayed there without struggling, the way a wild animal only would if it was dying. I didn't cry so much for the bird as for me and for Kenny and my dad. But yeah, I cried a bit for Rookie too.
That was fantastic. Thank you very much. Maybe you should become a talking book narrator.
I haven't got the skill. It's an actor's job, not a writer's, I'm afraid.
Well, Anthony McGowan, best of luck with the Sir Lip Carnegie. And thank you so much for coming in and being a guest on Read On.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you.
Many of Anthony's books are available in a range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library. For more information, go to the website rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and select option 5. And great news! Anthony so enjoyed reading that passage for us that he's now volunteered to narrate not just Rook, but Pike and Brock too, exclusively for the RNIB Talking Books Library. Now it's back to Lauren Wolk for the books of her life. So, Lauren, was there a book that you read as a young woman that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Yes, absolutely. Well, there were hundreds and hundreds of books. My parents read to me all the time, but there is one book that stands out. And I have to just preface that by giving you a quote from Albert Camus. One of my favorites. He said, "A man's work is nothing but this slow trek to discover through the detours of art those two or three great and simple images in whose presence his heart first opened." Well, of course, this is true of women as well. And for me, the book that stands as an image that opened my heart over and over again when I was a child was Goodnight Moon by Margaret Wise Brown. As a listener, as a very young listener, I was able to enter the world she created wholeheartedly and to be in that place, to hear those words the way my mother read them to me. It convinced me of the power of a writer to absorb a human being on a level that astounds. And so although I think I knew from the minute I was born that perhaps I had it in me to be a writer, it was that book, among others, but especially that book that convinced me that writing was the great art that I wanted to follow as I grew into an adult.
Goodnight Moon by Margaret Wise Brown is available in giant print from the RNIB Library and online in a variety of audio recordings. And is there a book that on a rainy day when you had nothing else to do, you'd like to curl up and reread?
Yeah, I thought about that question a lot, and I could not come up with a piece of fiction necessarily. It's poetry that takes me on a rainy day and many other days besides, but curling up with a wonderful book of poetry by a favorite poet and rereading the work is that's what really does it for me. And there are so many poets I love. I love Mary Oliver and Billy Collins, American poets, but perhaps my favorite poem on this planet is The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock and T.S. Eliot, one of my favorite poets. So to curl up with that one long, gorgeous, amazing poem on a rainy day, that's my idea of a little slice of heaven.
Let us go then, you and I, when the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table. Let us go through certain half-deserted streets, the muttering retreats of restless nights in one-night cheap hotels and sawdust restaurants with oyster shells. Streets that follow like a tedious argument of insidious intent to lead you to an overwhelming question. Oh, do not ask, what is it? Let us go and make our visit.
Mac Samples narrating The Love Song of J. Arthur Prufrock from The Collected Poems of T.S. Eliot, which is TB22153. And finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Yes, and I'm afraid that this will come across as a contrived answer because one of the characters is blind. But this is the book that I have recently read that so resonated with me that I know it's in the marrow of my bones and always will be. It's called All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. Some books just take you, you know, they just get their hands around you and they don't let go. And this is one of those books. I read all the time and I love many books, but there are not that many that do to me what that book did to me. I highly recommend it.
Leaflets. At dusk, they pour from the sky. They blow across the ramparts, turn cartwheels over rooftops, flutter into the ravines between houses. Entire streets swirl with them, flashing white against the cobbles. Urgent message to the inhabitants of this town, they say. Depart immediately to open country. The tide climbs. The moon hangs small and yellow and gibbous. On the rooftops of beachfront hotels to the east, and in the gardens behind them, a half dozen American artillery units drop incendiary rounds into the mouths of mortars.
Anthony Doerr's All the Light We Cannot See, narrated by Julie Teal, is TB22201, and it's also available in Braille and giant print from the RNIB Library. Thank you so much for sharing your love of reading and the story of Beyond the Bright Sea with us.
Thank you so much.
Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or you can find producer Robert on Twitter at talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.